Joseph's mother and Ruthie were already dressed in their nice Shabbos dresses. Joseph wore his best shirt and tie.
Bar mitzvah! There won't be enough men there to form a minyan, Papa said.
By tradition, 10 or more Jewish men, a minyan, was needed for a public service.
No. No one who has lived in Germany for the past 6 years would be so foolish as to go to a Jewish service aboard a Nazi ship.
Papa ran a hand over his shaved head.
No, it's a trap, meant to lure us out. That's when they'll snatch us. A trap.
Mama sighed.
All right, then. We'll go without you.
They left him pacing the room, muttering to himself. Joseph felt like someone had yanked his heart from his chest. In all the times he'd dreamed of this day, his father had always been there to recite a blessing with him.
But maybe this is what becoming a man is, Joseph thought. Maybe becoming a man means not relying on your father anymore.
Joseph, his mother, and Ruthie stopped short just inside the first-class social hall. There weren't the required 10 men for the service. There were 100 men, probably more, all wearing yarmulkes on their heads and white and black talisim, prayer shawls, around their shoulders. The card tables had been pushed to the sides of the room, and stewards were adding more chairs to accommodate the crowd. A table at the front held a Torah scroll. Joseph stood and stared. It felt like ages since he'd been inside a synagogue. It had been before Kristallnacht, before the Nuremberg laws that made Jews second-class citizens, before the boycotts and book burnings, before Jews were scared to gather together in public places. Joseph's parents had always taken him to synagogue with them on Shabbos, even when other parents left their children with their nannies. It all came flooding back to him now, swaying and humming along with the prayers, craning his neck to see the Torah when it was taken out of the ark, and hoping to get a chance to touch it and then kiss his fingers as the scroll came around in a procession. Joseph felt his skin tingle. The Nazis had taken all this from them, from him, and now he and the passengers on the ship were taking it back. Gustav Schroeder, the ship's diminutive captain, was there to greet them at the door. In the gallery above the room, a number of the off-duty crew had gathered to watch.
"Captain," asked a rabbi, one of the men who was leading the service, "I wonder if we might take down the portrait of the Führer, given the circumstances. It seems inappropriate for such a sacred moment to be celebrated in the presence of Hitler."
Joseph had seen paintings of the Nazi leader all over the ship, and the first-class social hall was no exception. A large portrait of Hitler hung in the middle of the room, watching over them all. Joseph's veins ran with ice. He hated that man. Hated him because of everything he'd done to the Jews, but mostly because of what Hitler had done to his father.
"Of course," Captain Schroeder said.
He quickly called over two of the stewards, and soon they had the portrait down and were taking it from the room. In the gallery above, Joseph saw one of the crew slam a fist down on the railing and storm off. Joseph's mother gave him a kiss on the cheek, and she and Ruthie went to sit in the section reserved for the women. Joseph took a seat in the section with the men. The rabbi stood in front of the crowd and read from Hosea. Then it was time for Joseph to recite the blessing he'd been practicing for weeks. There were butterflies in his stomach as he got up in front of such a large audience, and his voice broke as he stumbled through the Hebrew words, but he did it. He found his mother in the crowd. Her eyes were wet with tears.
"Today," Joseph said, "I am a man."
There were many hands to shake and many congratulations after the ceremony, but it was all a blur to Joseph. He felt like he was walking in a dream. For as long as he could remember, he'd wanted this, to no longer be a child, to be an adult. Joseph's mother and sister left to go back to visit his father in their cabin. Joseph walked the promenade deck by himself, a new man. Renata and Evelina jumped out from behind a lifeboat and grabbed Joseph by the hand. Without their parents on the ship, they had skipped synagogue to play.
"Joseph, come stand guard for us," Renata cried.
Before he could protest, the girls dragged him to a women's restroom. He was afraid they were going to pull him inside, but instead they deposited him by the door.
"Yell if you see someone coming," Renata said breathlessly.
We're going to latch all the stalls from the inside and crawl out under the doors so no one can use the toilets.
No, don't, Joseph tried to tell them, but they were already gone. He stood there awkwardly, not sure if he should stay or go. Soon the sisters ran back outside, hanging on to each other with laughter. A young woman staggered past them, clutching her stomach and looking green. Renata and Evelina got quiet, and Joseph could hear the woman desperately rattling the stall doors, looking for a toilet. The woman lurched out of the bathroom, looking even more green and desperate, and wobbled away. Renata and Evelina burst into laughter. Joseph raised himself up.
This isn't funny. Go in there and unlock those doors this minute. Just because you had your bar mitzvah doesn't make you an adult, Renata told him, and Evelina stuck her tongue out at him. Come on, Evie, let's do the bathrooms on A deck.
The girls tore away, and Joseph huffed. They were right. A bar mitzvah alone didn't make him an adult. Being responsible did. He walked on along the promenade, looking for a steward he could tell about the bathroom stalls. He saw two stewards who had stopped to look over the side at the sea and came up behind them.
Must be doing 16 knots easy, said one of the stewards. Captain's got the engines maxed out. Has to, the other said. Them other two ships is smaller and faster. They get to Cuba first and unload their passengers, and who knows? Cuba might decide she's full up with Jews when we get there and turn us away.
Joseph looked out to sea. There wasn't another ship on the horizon as far as he could see. What other ships were they talking about? More ships full of refugees? And why did it matter which one got there first? Hadn't everyone on board already applied and paid for visas? Cuba couldn't turn them away. Could they? One of the stewards shook his head.
There's something they're not telling us, the shipping company. Something they're not telling Schroeder. The captain's in a tight spot, he is. Wouldn't want to be him for all the sugar in Cuba.
Joseph backed away. He'd already forgotten about the stalls in the women's bathroom. If he and his family didn't make it to Cuba, if they weren't allowed in, where would they go?
Isabel. The Straits of Florida, somewhere north of Cuba, 1994. One day from home. Señor Castillo was in charge of the boat. No one had voted or named him captain, but he had built the boat after all, and he was the one at the rudder, steering it, so that put him in charge. He didn't look happy about it, though. He kept frowning at the motor and the rudder like there was something wrong. But besides a quick patch job of stuffing a sock into the bullet hole, everything was good. The lights of Havana had faded to a speck on the horizon behind them, and they had left all the other boats behind. Isabel clung to the wooden bench she sat on, squeezed in between Iván and her grandfather. Their boat was barely big enough for 7 people, and with Luis and his girlfriend, they were practically sitting on top of each other.
I think it's time we met the other person on board with us,
Isabel's grandfather said. Isabel thought he meant Luis's girlfriend, but instead he pushed some of the sacks of food and jugs of water out of the way and pointed to the bottom of the boat. Staring back up at them was the huge face of Fidel Castro. Luis's girlfriend gasped and then suddenly exploded with laughter. Soon all of them were laughing with her. Isabel laughed so hard her stomach hurt. Even grumpy Señor Castillo chuckled.
I needed something big and thick for the bottom of the boat, he said. And seeing as there were so many signs around with El Presidente's head on them.
It was true. Castro's face was everywhere in Cuba. On billboards, on taxis, in picture frames on schoolroom walls, painted on the sides of buildings. Underneath this painting were the words, Fight against the impossible and win.
Well, Fidel is thick-headed, Luis said.
Isabel put her hands to her mouth, but couldn't help laughing again with everyone else. You weren't allowed to say things like that in Cuba. But they weren't in Cuba anymore, were they?
Do you know what the greatest achievements of the Cuban Revolution are?
Isabel's father asked.
Education, public health, and sports,
they all said together. It was a constant refrain in Castro's lengthy speeches.
And do you know what the greatest failures are?
He asked.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner,
the adults answered back, as though they'd heard that one many times before, too. Isabel smiled. That prompted someone to break out food and drinks, even though it was late. Isabel sipped from a bottle of soda. How long will it take to get to Florida? She asked. Señor Castillo shrugged.
By tomorrow night, maybe. Tomorrow morning we'll have the sun to guide us.
All that matters now is we get as far away from Cuba as we can, said Luis's girlfriend.
And what is your name, pretty one?
Lito asked her. Amara, she said. She was very pretty, even in her blue police uniform. She had flawless olive skin, long black hair, and full red lips.
No, no, no,
Lito said. He fanned his face.
Your name must be Summer, because you're making me sweat.
The girl smiled, but Isabel's mother slapped Lito on the leg.
Papi, stop it. You're old enough to be her grandfather.
Lito just took that as a challenge. He put his hands over his heart.
I wish I was your favorite song, he told Amara, so I could be on your lips forever. If your eyes were the sea, I would drown in them.
Lito was giving her piropos, the flirtatious compliments Cuban men said to women on the street. Not everyone did it anymore, but to Lito it was like an art form. Amara laughed, and Luis smiled.
Maybe we shouldn't talk about drowning,
Papi said, clutching to the side of the boat as they chopped into a wave.
What do you think the States will be like? Isabel's mother asked everyone.
Isabel had to stop and think about that. What would the United States be like? She hadn't had much time to even imagine it.
Shelves full of food at the store, Señora Castillo said.
Being able to travel anywhere we want, any time we want, said Amara.
I want to be able to choose who I vote for, Luis said.
I want to play baseball for the New York Yankees, Ivan said.
I want you to go to college first, his mother told him.
I want to watch American television, Ivan said.
The Simpsons.
I am going to open my own law office, Señora Castillo said.
Isabel listened as everyone listed more and more things they were looking forward to in the States. Clothes, food, sports, movies, travel, school, opportunity. It all sounded so wonderful. But when it came down to it, all Isabel really wanted was a place where she and her family could be together and happy.
What do you think El Norte will be like, Papi?
Isabel asked. Her father looked surprised at the question.
No more ministry of telling people what to think or else, he said. No more getting thrown in jail for disagreeing with the government.
But what do you want to do when you get there?
Señor Castillo asked. He hesitated while everyone stared at him, his eyes searching Castro's face on the bottom of the boat, as though there were answers hidden there.
Be free, Papi said finally.
Let's have a song,
Lito said.
Chabela, play us a song on your trumpet.
Isabel's chest tightened. She'd told her parents what she'd done, but not Lito. She knew he would never have let her do it.
I traded my trumpet, she confessed, for the gasoline.
Her grandfather was shocked.
But that trumpet was everything to you.
No, not everything, Isabel thought. It wasn't my mother and father, and you, Lito.
I'll get another one in the States, she said.
Lito shook his head.
Here. Let's have a song anyway.
He began singing a salsa song and tapping out the rhythm on the side of the metal boat. Soon the whole boat was singing, and Lito stood and held out a hand to Amara, inviting her to dance.
Papi, sit down! You'll fall out of the boat!
Isabel's mother told him.
I can't fall out of the boat, because I have already fallen for this princess of the sea, he said.
Amara laughed and took his hand, and the two of them danced as best they could in the swaying boat. Mommy started counting clave by clapping, and Isabel frowned, trying to follow the beat.
Still can't hear it, Chavela?
Lito asked. Isabel closed her eyes and focused. She could almost hear it. Almost. And then the motor spluttered and died, and the music stopped.
Mahmoud, Kilis, Turkey, 2015, 2 days from home. Mahmoud could hear music beyond the fence. It was hard to see for all the people. He stood in a long line with his family, waiting at the border to gain admission into Turkey near the city of Kilis. Around them were countless more Syrian families, all hoping to be let in. They carried everything they owned with them, sometimes in suitcases and duffel bags, but more often stuffed into pillowcases and trash bags. The men wore jeans and t-shirts and tracksuits. The women wore dresses and abayas and hijabs. Their children looked like miniature versions of them and acted like miniature adults, too. There was very little crying and whining, and none of the kids were playing. They had all walked too far and seen too much. After leaving the car behind, Mahmoud and his family had followed the map on their phone, skirting cities held by Daesh and the Syrian army and the rebels and the Kurds, as best they could. Google Maps told them it would be an 8-hour walk, and they split the journey up by sleeping in a field. It was hot out by day, but it got cold at night, and Mahmoud and his family had left all their extra clothes in the car, in their haste to escape. The next morning, they had seen the people. Dozens of them. Hundreds. Refugees, just like Mahmoud and his family, who had left their homes in Syria and were walking north to Turkey. To safety. Mahmoud and his family had fallen into step with them and disappeared among their ranks. Invisible. Just as Mahmoud liked it. Together, the shambling throng of refugees was ignored by the American drones and the rebel rocket launchers and the Syrian army tanks and the Russian jets. Mahmoud heard explosions and saw smoke clouds, but no one cared about a few hundred Syrian people leaving the battlefield. And now they were in line with him. All those hundreds of people and thousands more, and they weren't invisible anymore. Turkish guards in light green camo gear, with automatic weapons and white surgical masks over their faces, walked up and down the line, staring at each of them in turn. Mahmoud felt like he was in trouble. He wanted to look away, but he was worried that might make the guards think he was hiding something. But if he looked right at them, they would notice him, maybe pull him and his family out of line. Mahmoud stared straight ahead at his father's back instead. His father's shirt was stained at the armpits, and with a quick sniff of his own shirt, Mahmoud realized he stank too. They had walked for hours in the hot sun without a bath, without a change of clothes. They looked tired and poor and wretched. If he were a Turkish border guard, he wouldn't have let in any of these dirty, squalid people, himself included. Mahmoud's father kept their papers tucked into his pants under his shirt, along with all of their money, the only other things they owned now, besides 2 phones and 2 chargers. When Mahmoud and his family finally got to the front of the line, late in the day, Mahmoud's father presented their official documents to the border agent. After what seemed like an eternity of looking over their papers, the border guard finally stapled temporary visas onto their passports and let them through. They were in Turkey! Mahmoud couldn't believe it. Step after step, kilometer after kilometer, he'd begun to think they would never, ever escape Syria. But as relieved as he was, he knew they still had so very far to go. Ahead of them stretched a small city of white canvas tents, their pointed tops staggered like